Welcome back, WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. I've got the hat on here. You know, I'm dressing up a little bit today. I don't know why. Maybe it's springtime coming around here. Maybe I can take my wife on a weekend over to Stay Fair. Some chicken and waffles, some shrimp and grits. Certainly over to El Guapo, where I plan on having some grown-up drinks once spring hits. Please support all of our sponsors, including our friends at Fadley's. I am rolling out a little crab cake idea I'm going to be talking about, probably taking Don Moeller on the road. Don, how do you feel about crab cakes? I've seen you eat a couple of crab cakes. What makes a perfect crab cake in your mind, Don?
No filler. Very, very little filler. And although there's this great debate, and I see our guests nodding, between fried and broiled, I know broiled is better for you. I get that. But if I had my druthers, I'm going to say, let me have it fried.
As and you know, the mother was Southern. You know, best, so it's fried in my house.
The best tip that I got, Nestor, was from our dear friend Nancy Devine, the godmother of all crab cakes at Fadley's. We were talking to her one day, and she said something to me that in my entire life, six-plus decades, I'd never heard. She said, a crab cake has to be eaten at a moderately warm temperature, not cold and not piping hot. You want it to cool down just a little bit so that it's moderately warm. And we started doing that once Nancy said it. And that was a game. I mean, I love crab cakes anyway, but that was a game changer. That was a great tip.
Well, I'll tell you what, you've got some great guests here. You are the executive producer of all things Baltimore Positive. And I look down and it's amazing the wide variety of folks we've talked to here in the recent weeks. Did a lot with the Maryland Hospital Association this week. I had some political folks on, folks running for office and controller over the last week with Tim Adams as well as with Brooke Learman. But, you know, now we're reaching out even more into our community here and inviting old friends of yours on. We don't usually green room around here, but you were talking Little League with this guy, right?
Well, you know, it makes me feel really old. I don't know about our guest, the executive director of the Baltimore Jewish Council, Harold Libet. But when I get ready for this segment and I start thinking of our relationship, Harold, and I go, oh, come on now. Wait a minute. This many years. Wait a minute. You mean I've known Howard for almost 20 years? I was like going, come on, guys.
How no, 25 probably, Don. 25. I mean, it goes back to 95, 96 when you were in the Baltimore County schools and I was a young education reporter for the Baltimore Sun.
And you were there, Howard, in an exciting time, to say the least.
Don loves inviting former Baltimore Sun people on because we're all a club, right, Hal? I mean,
yeah,
you know what
right,
I mean? Like
right.
I mean, alumni association around here.
You were at the Sun for 15 years, right, Howard?
Right. I got there in 94 and I left in 2009.
Yeah, I mean, you started as a puppy reporter and ended up as a big-time editor running this show down there. I mean, you were the man. Talk about those, you know, we say never a straight line here, and we'll get into all the important work that you're doing at the Baltimore Jewish Council. But since Nestor jumped into the Sun,
well, I'm a newspaper guy. We get
yeah, free, I know.
You
know,
we're always save our Sun. That's all we do around.
I understand. Let's start with the Sun. Talk about your 15 years here. First of all, Howard, start with your career in journalism, how you got interested in journalism, how you ended up at the Sun, and then what you saw, how it evolved over those 15 years.
Let me guess, you wanted to be a sports writer.
No, I did a little bit of that in college. Got into a shouting match with the men's basketball coach one time.
Where was that? I've had a lot of those.
I was out of Stanford, and they were having a terrible season. And
Montgomery?
I asked Yeah. And he I asked the question, how does it feel to set the school record for most losses in a season?
Ooh.
That didn't go over well. But I
think about how you phrase that.
Hey, you know, you only get one shot. I was offered a 2-year internship at the Sun midway through my senior year of college there. And sight unseen, having visited Baltimore basically for a night to interview for the job, I moved to Baltimore from the West Coast. And
where'd
I've
you
been
grow
here
up?
Ever since. I grew up in the Chicago area.
All right. Well, you get good pizza at least.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. So I drove cross country by myself. Here I am. And it was an amazing, you know, spent my first 3 years out in Howard County writing about schools back in a time when the Sun newsroom at one point in those early years, you can remember, was like 400 people. reporters, editors. It's
so much talent. You know what I mean? Like how hard it was to get a gig there. You know what I mean? I felt honored to be in the mailroom when I got there. And, you know, every day on Twitter, I see kids saying, I just got a job at the LA Times or the New York Times. And, you know, I'm crying. I remember all those emotions. You know, I mean, it was a big deal to have a job at the paper.
And the Sun was, I mean, remember there were seven or eight foreign bureaus. There was a 10-person Washington bureau. There was in the State House, they had six or seven reporters every session. And we had these suburban bureaus that were, 12, 14 people covering Baltimore County and 12 in Howard County and Anne Arundel and Carroll and Harford. And, you know, toward the end, as I was assistant managing editor for news and, you know, the budget was squeezing, I was the one who had to go through and say, okay, we're shutting down these physical offices and having to make job decisions and encourage people to take buyouts and layoffs. I mean, is the hardest one was we had some layoffs, and there was a couple of two-year interns who were the lowest rung of the seniority, so they had to be cut first. And one of them was a young woman who I think I'd met once, and she'd been there about 6 months. She was in Florida attending a journalism conference we'd sent her to, and I had to call her because I had to notify her right away. And I'm reaching her on her cell phone, and she's at the airport waiting to come back. And I tell her, and she's in tears. And her only question to me was, is my airplane ticket home still good? And it just was heartbreaking. And it kind of gave me the decision, like, I got to find something else because I can't continue to lay people off. It was just too difficult on me emotionally.
Howard, this is why we do Baltimore Positive, to give folks an insight into a world that they may not be familiar with. Go to 10,000 feet for a minute. Now, we've had some really great some folks on. I mean, we've had, you know, Frazier's a regular, Barry Raskovar is a regular. We had Tom Linthicum on. He was just fantastic. Go to 10,000 feet and talk about what it was that was happening in the nation and in journalism that made it necessary for the Sun to devolve into that place where you said, for my mental health, I can't do this anymore. What was going on that made all of that happen for our listeners, Howard?
You know, revenues kept shrinking. You know, newspaper circulation shrunk and advertising revenue shrunk, and the internet.
The internet's people, everything, right?
The internet's everything. Yeah. People came to expect that their news was going to be free and
not on paper.
as much as you see those digital ads early on, you know, they were tiny. And so you would sit there and hear, you know, digital advertising increased by 150%. But when it's a fraction of a tiny amount, increasing 150% still doesn't pay the bills. They've caught on now. I mean, there's digital subscriptions that generates more revenue. It's a good thing, but it was really hard.
Howard, I've heard people, it's probably an oversimplification, but since you were really focused on the business side, maybe you can tell us whether it is an oversimplification. But I heard that three sectors really were the death knell: the loss of the classifieds, the loss of the real estate ads, and the loss of the auto ads. Those three sectors carried the paper.
And then you look at the economic recession of 2008 or so, which killed off a bunch of department stores. I mean, think about all those pages of ads that Macy's used to have, and all the other department stores that filled the Sunday papers, and that's all gone.
Well, Sears would have a giant insert in there, right? Sure.
Right. I mean, so the kind of death, the what the two economic collapses have done to retail has really, really hurt. And unfortunately, a lot of companies, when they're looking to balance the budget, am I going to cut back on my advertising or am I going to lay people off? The first effort is cut back on advertising.
Look, I'm aware of that. I own an AM radio station, Hal.
Yeah, I know. It's hard all the way around.
Howard Liberty's here. You know, we came in to talk about the community and all your good work. And we're diving into one of our favorite areas here, journalism and the deep dive. But so much for our community, I guess over the last year in pandemic life and where we are, we try to reset. I always say BC, before COVID, you know, and I don't know what the aftermath is going to be. And I think we're going to be spending large swaths of time this year talking about what the paradigm shift in everything that this year has occurred.
Absolutely. I mean, it's almost exactly a year now, right? And our lives have gone virtual. A year ago, we would be sitting around a studio talking face to face, right? Instead of each of us at wherever we are remotely. My board meetings were always in person. Our programming was in person. We could reach out to people. I went to my office yesterday. It was about the fifth or sixth time I've been in my office in a year. I had to go in basically to print and sign some tax forms.
Well, Mueller and I get together twice a week, but Don, have we been physically in the same room three times in the last year, maybe four?
No, you know,
I've been in your backyard dropping stuff off, but that's right. Only happening.
It's remote.
I haven't been in a room with Don this calendar year. I don't think we've been together in 21, right? Literally.
I do not think so.
And it feels weird because I've spent 10 hours a week with you here talking to people, you know?
Well, it is. And we miss Howard. You mentioned not seeing the staff, that transition that everyone has had to make. You know, we've missed being out with our friends at Fadley's and our friends at State Fair.
Oh, you're missing chicken and waffles,
you
dude.
Know,
you have no idea.
you know, interacting with all the staff that we got to know and got to work with. What has been the challenge for you? First of all, let's again back up. Let's put it in reverse. Tell folks, they probably hear the Baltimore Jewish Council. They see you on TV. They hear you on radio when an issue arises, often in the area of hate crimes or anti-Semitism, some of those things. But tell folks what the Baltimore Jewish Council is and what its mission is.
Sure. So we are a nonprofit. We are the advocacy arm of the Associated Jewish Federation of Baltimore and the broader Jewish community. So we I have a large board that is comprised of representatives of synagogues and other Jewish institutions across the region. And we work really in five areas: advocacy, whether it's federal, state, or local legislative advocacy or other areas. We work on interfaith relations and intrafaith relations. So we do a lot of the work reaching out to other faith communities, other communities across the area, and do work with them, as well as trying to build stronger relations across the different parts of the Jewish communities. Our fourth area we work on is Israel education and advocacy. And then we work on fighting anti-Semitism. And that includes our systems director of security is on my staff. We oversee a lot of the Holocaust remembrance and education. So the annual commemoration events we run. And so I have a staff of, there's 10 of us total. The Elijah Cummings Youth Program in Israel is also part of our team, which is a program that identifies a dozen kids who live in the 7th Congressional District. And it's a two-year program of leadership and community service that includes a summer trip to Israel in between their junior and senior year. And these kids go on to all go to college and have...
That's competitive, huh? How many kids apply for that?
It's a competitive. I mean, you get 40 to 50 kids applying at the end of their sophomore year. And the for Congressman Cummings for 20 years and now Congressman Mfume... those kids walk in a room, or now a virtual room, and Congressman Cummings would always ask the booming first question with all 20 members of the board sitting around a table. What an intimidating experience for a 15 or 16 year old. But the congressman forged relationships with these kids. If you turn on CNN on Saturday morning, the co-host Victor was one of the first alumni of the program. I mean, there's some phenomenal fellows who have grown up through that program.
And, how many years has that been going on now?
So that's 21, 22 wow. years about. And so when
Elijah was here a while.
Yeah. I mean, it started right after. The funny thing is the launching of the program had been in the works when Congressman Mfume was in Congress then.
First time around.
And then he resigned and Congressman Cummings was elected, and the process had been in the works between African-American and Jewish leaders to create it. And so Congressman Cummings picked it up and ran with it. And we're thrilled that Congressman Cummings, Congressman Mfume has agreed to join as the honorary chairman. And Jennifer Cummings, one of Congressman Cummings' daughters, is now on the board as well. It's really, it does a lot to build African-American Jewish relations among those teams. Howard,
so much, as I said, unfortunately, and so much of your work is still focused on the fight against hate, the fight against anti-Semitism. And I will be forever, ever grateful for your leadership and really mentorship of me on that horrific day of October 27th, 2018, when a crazed individual walked into the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, killing 11 people, I think injuring 6 others. And you truly brought together local governmental leaders, faith leaders, for this incredible memorial service that's etched in my brain to this day. For me, very personal, because I think, as I said that day, the last time I had been in that synagogue was for the service for my good friend, Kevin Kamenetz, who also worked so hard on these issues. So to return to that synagogue where we had said goodbye to my very good friend and now be talking about a mass murder of 11 people. I mean, you really orchestrated that in a matter of hours.
It was the next morning, like Sunday morning, you know, it happened Saturday. And by Sunday morning, I think it was 9 or 10 o'clock in the morning. We had what a phenomenal turnout. What a meaningful event, followed by the following Friday, where we brought together, the governor and leaders of the Catholic Church and the Episcopal Church and all that came together to light candles the following Friday. It was just, and that really caused us to rethink a lot, security wise, thinking about hate. It really focused you. Followed, of course, shortly thereafter by what happened in San Diego with that synagogue. And New Jersey, I mean, you've seen these unbelievably violent incidents that you never thought. This is the United States. How can we be seeing this? And not just Jewish synagogues. You know, you saw it at mosques. You've seen it at black churches down in the South. I mean, it's...
Well, what's happened now with this, with the Asian American population, yeah, with what's been done politically with the virus, right, is insane. I mean, it feels like anyone could. I mean, I'm of Latin descent, right? So it's easy to be a target of anything in America in a lot of ways. And I think security is something that no one wants to think about in a place of worship, right?
Because you want to be welcoming, but you also want to be secure, and you don't want to be profiling people who come into your place of worship and think, do they belong here or not? Because of the color of their skin or other reasons. So you really have to work hard. I mean, the federal government, right after 9/11, thanks to Senator Mikulski and others, created a system of nonprofit grants that faith institutions and other nonprofits can apply to harden their security for things like cameras and fences and personnel. And that's really been a huge benefit. And the state has followed too. So in the last couple of years, there are grants available for both faith institutions at risk of hate crimes and schools and daycare centers. We help. My director of security provides assessments for institutions that, you know, want to know, what do I need to do to toughen our security? And we don't just do it for the Jewish synagogues and all. When my friend Earl El Amin calls wanting the mosque in West Baltimore to get a security assessment too, because he's looking to apply, our director of security goes over there too. Really, it cuts across faiths, as you said, Nestor, and we try and help all the different faiths. I mean, security just brings us together in ways, because none of us and responding to hate. I mean, I remember when Kevin Kamenetz brought in, you know, took some steps to protect the Muslim community and stepped and did some things, and we were proud to join that. It was really important. We have to be allies of everybody.
You know, Howard, I want to get back to a minute in terms of what your organization does and how we combat this, because that I know is a topic that's always front and center with our listeners and with Nestor. But when you mentioned, you know, Kevin stepping up to protect the mosque, I've told this story before, but I always think it's worth repeating that in that very first week when the former guy, as they call him, moved to ban Muslims. I will, you know, you knew Kevin well. Kevin wasn't a warm and fuzzy kind of guy. People can hear him out there chuckling. You're chuckling. I mean, people are chuckling now. Go,
well, he was always warm to me. I mean, I don't know. He must have liked me more than anybody else. I'll tell you.
A little bit. He liked you, Nestor. A little bit did. Understated. They're going, hey, Don, yeah, that's sort of understated. But what they didn't see in Kevin was this incredibly empathic component, particularly when it came to children and families. And when the former guy instituted that Muslim ban, this Jewish county executive walked into my office that morning, and he rarely was without words, but he was just, I can see him, he's just putting his hands up and he's going, what are we becoming? What are we becoming? This cannot be who we are. He was so troubled. And that really formed his actions in many ways for the next few years. So with it, that question that he raised, Howard, who are we becoming? Talk a little bit about, from your perspective now, having sat in that chair, what are you doing and what do we need to be doing so that we're not just shaking our fist all the time, but making a difference? What's making a difference?
So we've invested a lot of time and energy into that. Actually, in spring of 2019, we brought together leaders from across the Jewish community to sit down and talk about it and formed a task force. And we put out a real strong action plan in November that talked about, there's really four areas that we see we have to focus on and but keep doing what we're doing in some areas and build more, education, both of the Jewish community about what anti-Semitism and hate is and the broader community. We have to focus on allyship. So like we can't expect people to stand with us when we're the targets if we're not standing with them when they're the targets. We need to talk about advocacy. So it's toughening hate crimes laws, speaking out whenever there's an incident, and then tracking and reporting incidents, because we're never going to know if we're doing better. And we're not going to be able to respond if we aren't tracking what we're doing. And that's going to involve partnerships within the Jewish community, with ADL, with other organizations nationally, but also with lots of other partners across the region. And it means the elected officials. So it means something as simple as, can we help education, government, and corporations better identify hate and better respond to it? Some of them have programs in place, but they don't necessarily have the resources for the additional training they need. How do we educate kids about hate? I mean, one of the things I'm proudest of is us persuading the state superintendent as they're rewriting the social studies curriculum in the state to add more specific components of teaching about the Holocaust and the roots of the Holocaust, because our state standards in that area were really lacking. And she's agreed, and they're working on it, elementary, middle, and high school. And in middle school, they're going to teach about anti-Semitism and how it led to the roots of the Holocaust. So when kids learn more about it in high school and learn more of the horrific details, they'll understand the root causes. And that's really teaching about hate, teaching about genocide. We've got to raise a generation of kids who understand what this world is capable of and how they need to be upstanders.
Howard, I know you follow this. It's such an important topic, and I know you track it. What's the status, and I know some of it you probably can't share for security purposes, but what's the status of hate groups across Maryland and across the region? What's your sense, and what do your security analysts tell you?
So it's there. We've been fortunate. We haven't had the violent incidents that we've seen elsewhere for the most part, ranging from we obviously haven't had any of the massive attacks like the in Pittsburgh or at the Poway Synagogue in San Diego. And we also haven't had the violent attacks like you've heard about on the streets of New York, where, Orthodox Jews have been attacked. We have great relationships with law enforcement here. They look out, but the little stuff is definitely increasing. The reports of the swastikas drawn at different places, the nasty flyers being left, whether it's here or in Harford County or South Baltimore, there's periodically flyers being left of recruiting for different hate groups. It's definitely something that we have to be vigilant of. And in fact, there's a bill in the General Assembly that we're supporting this year from Delegate Rosenberg and Senator Hedelman that will create a task force to study domestic terrorism and to figure out what we need to do both legislatively to help fight it and what additional resources we might need to invest. But there is a terrific criminal intelligence system at the state level, as well as at our local law enforcement levels, that really do a great job of tracking and responding. And when we have something, we let them know, and they jump all over it and really look at it. And so even if you see us, even when a synagogue or a Jewish day school reports a suspicious driver hanging out, you know, get a picture of the light, they get a little picture of the license plate, police will go check into it. And, you know, it could be someone, you know, sometimes it's as simple as a potential bidder on a lawn care contract scoping out the property for what they want to bid. But sometimes it's someone who's taken strange pictures and it needs to be followed up and you want to be sure.
Howard Libert is our guest executive director of the Baltimore Jewish Council. We're talking about all sorts of things of faith in our community and holding people together and doing good things on a daily basis, on a weekly basis, moving forward the next 3 to 6 months of this pandemic. How much have things changed inside of your organization for things you could actually do? Because you're obviously reaching people. I mean, you put people together in one night, you can touch something and make things happen. As we see vaccines, these other issues for your organization, what's it been like? And what do you see for 2021 as far as change from what we all planned a year ago that didn't happen?
Still no prospects for travel to Israel for okay. quite a while.
By the way, you talk about the country leading the earth in vaccines.
Vaccines,
right?
Sure, absolutely. But it's just going to be a while till you can, I mean, it's, but, you know, all of our programming has been online, which is great in the sense of it, there's a vehicle there for people, you know, whether it's an Israel education program. We have, I think, 120 registered for a program next week about anti-Semitism in Israel. It's great to reach a crowd like that. Board meeting attendance, because it's virtual as opposed to having to drive some places, sometimes better than ever. At the same time,
food's not as good.
Food's not as right. There's no kosher buffet, as Don knows, like we've had at our board meetings. But one of the great challenges is a lot of, for example, our Holocaust commemoration work. A lot of that is aimed at the older population of Holocaust survivors who aren't particularly digitally inclined. And so we're having to ask their children to please bring a computer over to the house and show them the program, engage with them, because it's harder to reach some of those folks. And a lot of time we're spending advocating on behalf of our agencies that help vulnerable communities, whether it's Jewish Community Services or whether it's Chai, there's providing food. They're providing, mental health care. They're providing, assistance to people who have housing vulnerabilities, reaching the seniors, trying to get vaccines for, not just Holocaust survivors who are in their 80s and 90s, but all the seniors who are that age and who may not have a lot of computer capability. Even my parents who have some computer capability have struggled to get a vaccine. So it's really a remarkable time, and also figuring out how you're going to continue. I mean, I don't have to raise, the Associated raises money for all the Jewish agencies in our community, but it's hard. It's a hard time to be, because as a lot of people have suffered a lot economically with jobs and other things. And so you're fortunately, a lot of generous people have stepped up. But it's a challenging time for a lot of our agencies.
Hey, Howard, I know I know we're on a limited time frame here. Appreciate the generosity of you with your time. Talk a little bit, because I think the Baltimore Jewish Council is involved in some redevelopment efforts in Park Heights and Pimlico. And I know that we've had, Reverend Hathaway on. He's involved in other projects across the city. It's Baltimore Positive. So when we hear redevelopment in Park Heights and Pimlico, our ears perk up.
Yes, we were among
them. My Keep the Preakness in Baltimore pin that O'Malley gave me, but I got it somewhere around here.
Yeah, I have some of those too. We were among the biggest cheerleaders with our partners across Park Heights for the legislation that was passed last year for the to redevelop the Pimlico Race Course, to tear that down and build a new track and all of that. We've been huge supporters of that, organizing the community, and are looking forward to contributing to what happens there in terms of the out parcels, the development. I mean, because it's not just the track now. We're going to have an opportunity to hopefully put something like a grocery store, which the community badly needs, other services. We've been advocates on behalf of Sinai Hospital, who's going to be building an outpatient care building on part of what's had been parking lots, which will, again, bring more employees, bring more people there. There's a real economic engine that across the community, the Jewish communities, the Black community, the Latino community that's part of the neighborhood, all has been very supportive of, and also figuring out what we're going to do, what's going to happen. I mean, there's another big parcel there. That old Pimlico Junior High School that had been the Public Safety Training Academy, which at some point is going to be redeveloped as well. And what can we make sure goes there so it's not another vacant building at a high profile corner? There's a really exciting possibilities for what's going to come for Northwest Baltimore. And we were just grateful to work on it and are, you know, working across Park Heights. We have a One Park Heights initiative trying to bring to, I mean, I think for many years people saw Northern Parkway is the dividing line. And we're trying to erase that dividing line and really bring together the communities to focus together on how we can move all of Park Heights forward.
All right, very, very, very excited. Hey, before we let you run, Nestor's going to scream in chat that you and I are the only two Oriole fans left. I was going to cut you off before you started to make
fun. I
grew up a Cubs fan, but I've been an Orioles partial season ticket holder since before my kids were born. My son is 14 now. We used to have two tickets, and then he was born, and after a couple years, went to three tickets, and then my daughter, and we're at four Sunday tickets.
Lot of losing in your life being a Cubs fan. And then did you cancel out the Cubs or did you celebrate the Cubs a few years ago?
Oh, no, I still celebrate the Cubs. Remember, they're a
real fan. You got a real championship. You're never going to get another one. It's good for you that you did it that way.
They're a National
Negative,
League.
Mr. Negative.
I remember, you know, those exciting Orioles playoff years of the late 90s, watching, you know, Messina. Sitting up there in the stadium when Messina pitched those 10 innings and still lost in one of those playoff games. And we put in our time on the Orioles.
I'm assuming that you're all in for the rebuild. Nestor knows I'm all in for the rebuild. I'm willing to lose one or two more years.
Incompetence, Howard. That's where I am. It's the same problem with the former administration. You know, the bullying, the incompetence, those sort of things turn – when they took my press pass 15 years ago, how – I understand you were in the media at one point.
Hard
to root for people to take your credentials.
Based on their free agent signings, they have a heck of a rotation for 2012.
They're going to come,
you know.
Doug Maybach's coming back, dude. I'm telling you.
Felix Hernandez and the guy from the Mets. Boy, if they were in their prime, what a rotation!
Well, they're going to be here, as I tell Nestor. They're going to be here for a long time. That makes me happy. I am confident.
He believes when they say things in the paper.
I will attend a World Series game with my grandsons, and Adley Rutschman will be an MVP, and Grayson Hernandez will be competing for a Cy Young Award. Howard, go ahead.
No, I'll say I had never been quoted in an Orioles article before until last fall when you had the first Israeli-born Orioles pitcher with that great couple of starts.
Absolutely.
And I was asked, well, are synagogues going to organize stuff? I'm like, well, they would if we could go to Camden Yards. I'm sure we would find a way to organize, you know, Jewish Night at the Park. But
Year. It's been terrific. Hope you'll come back, you know, regularly and just sort of update us, keep us posted. Baltimore Jewish Council, one of the really, really important groups fighting to make Baltimore City better, quite frankly, fighting to make our state and our nation better. So thanks for everything you've done.
Thanks for the
opportunity. I hope we get you back on, Howard, sometime soon. And you know, Mahler drops all this alphabet soup about like politics and like all the, and when you said assistant manager, I'm like an AME, you know what I mean? So, you know, I knew what that meant, you know what I mean? And I didn't, So a little newspaper lingo there from 501 North Calvert Street at one point. Howard Libert joining us here. And I tell you what, getting more and more local people on is what we're doing around here. If you have not seen all of our hospital coverage with the Maryland Hospital Association, make sure you're checking that out at Baltimore Positive, including chats with Ted Venatoulis this week as well. We always get some wisdom from Uncle Ted. Make sure you're checking that out. It'll also be in the podcast audio vault. Big shout out to all of our sponsors, including our friends at Fadley's. I'm planning something with crab cakes. That's all I'm going to say, and it's going to be something that's going to fill me up, and it's not going to have a lot of filler. So Don Moeller will eat it as well. We are WNST.net, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore. We never stop talking Baltimore sports and a little bit of journalism and baseball too.